Hey folks, we're back. It's a goodlifebabe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans, episode 86.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's a goodlifebabe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans, episode 86. We're very happy to have a special guest in the house, Melissa Arujo from Alma Nola pop-up restaurant. Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
We're going to talk to Melissa tonight about several things, about Rue Carré over on Aretha Castle Haley. We're going to talk about her background as a Honduran born and bred chef, now New Orleanian, and her projects, culinary style and whatnot. And we're going to get a little bit into the MLK upcoming on Monday, MLK block party on Aretha Castle Haley that the Alma Nola is going to be co-hosting with some other folks as part of the New Orleans Tricentennial. So that's fun. We got a little bit of housekeeping. Everybody knows that listens to the pod. We do a little bit of that at the top. And Melissa, I want to thank you for coming in. This is how New Orleans rolls, folks. We had guests lined up for this week. And then, Jeff, I'll let you take it here to come talk about the ordinance, the security camera surveillance ordinance that the city council was looking to vote on today.
Yeah, we like to call it the Head Landrieu camera surveillance ordinance.
Yeah, the Stacey Head Mitch Landrieu.
Right, yeah, exactly. So the rub of it is this: if you haven't been paying attention online, at outlets like the Louisiana Restaurant Association or at the Music and Culture Coalition of New Orleans, otherwise known as MACNO, Stacey Head, at the request of Mitch Landrieu, contrived this ordinance whereby every alcohol beverage outlet in the city of New Orleans would be required to pay for, maintain, and install cameras, which then would feed into a central surveillance bank, which is part of this security rollout that Mitch Landrieu is doing, ostensibly, I believe, in conjunction with the 300-year anniversary of the city, to meet certain money pressure requirements that are happening in back rooms for guests that will be coming into the city of New Orleans, probably as a result, it's been theorized, of like overbaked concerns about terrorism threats and whatnot. But and so we're seeing all of, there's a host of measures that have happened. This one happens to be the most invasive and intrusive aspects of many different ideas that are happening. So long and short of it is this, is that ordinance, like things that happen with the New Orleans City Council a lot, got pushed back because there was a lot of community response and pushback. They tried, as Stacey has tried to do many times in her vaunted career as a representative of the city of New Orleans, to sneak it in during the Christmas break when nobody's looking, which also happened during the noise ordinance. But of course, due to the good folks at MACNO, they are paying attention to the docket that gets presented at the city council each and every day. Right. So to anybody out there, especially our new representatives, our newly elected representatives that are coming in, if you have some of these cockamamie ideas and you think that you're going to get them past the filter of the community watching them, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah, Stacey had ruined that for y'all.
Yeah, Stacey had fucked it up.
Because she fucked it up for you.
You used to be able to do that.
That's right.
Right, just we curse on this podcast.
She was too blatant about it.
She was too blatant about it. And so anyway, they tried to sneak it in during the Christmas thing. It got pushed back. Right, there was a little bit of community pushback at that time. That gave a nice little window of opportunity. I'll give myself a little pat on the back. I got together with the MACNO people and produced an ad that was put out on social media. It was a public service announcement, and where we explained to the public what this camera surveillance stuff was about, how it was going to impact disproportionately communities of color and also immigrant groups in the city. And one of the worst parts about it is that, you know, there was going to be a cooperative endeavor between the New Orleans Police Department and Department of Homeland Security, ICE, other federal branches of government, if they wanted access to footage in order to like find and locate people that they were looking for, that NOPD was going to cooperate and turn over that surveillance footage to them, right, sight unseen, without anybody knowing that any of this was taking place whatsoever, which should send a chill up anybody's spine when you're considering the fact that we're in a Donald Trump, Jeff Sessions world right now, because you know they're going to use it for any reason that they can possibly use it for. So anyway, it that you know, the public service announcement and the Magno pushback and the Louisiana Restaurant Association pushback and the community pushback all combined to get a deferral, meaning that the vote has now been pushed back ostensibly to January 25th. And what I was trying to explain to people is that, to me, that's a small victory. In my experience with the way things go down with the New Orleans City Council is that when you get a deferment, it means that people are thinking twice and they're thinking more deeply. I don't necessarily know if they're really actually thinking about it.
Hopefully they want to be measured. They want to maybe do some straw polling amongst their advisors and constituencies
and community input,
and making sure they don't, you know.
But as signs go in politics, you know, the signposts are basically like, if you get a deferment and then another deferment and then another deferment and another deferment,
yeah,
like,
it's a good thing.
I think like four or five deferments, you're pretty much starting to talk about the end of a bill.
Exactly.
You know, so
exactly.
Like, so I know that it's nerve wracking for people because a lot of people just want to get the vote over with and they want it to be defeated, you know, but this is how politics goes. It never happens overnight.
Look at what's happening with DACA on a national level.
Yeah,
right now.
Exactly.
It's nerve wracking is why I thought about that.
It's totally nerve wracking. Right. And
so those little small victories don't necessarily say, well, you're in the clear. It's just a small victory.
So I'll just round it up by saying this. People out there, don't rest on your laurels over this thing. All right, get more activated about it, because what you need to understand is that we need to amplify the pushback even more
call your city council person. That's really easy to do, folks. Find out what district you live in. Go to NOLA.gov, find out what district you live in, and call and email your city council.
Also, you need to go to the ACLU website for New Orleans, and they have a petition that they're having people sign.
That's
and,
right.
And they're delivering that to the city of New Orleans. That's an ongoing effort.
Magno
as well
has a petition as well.
Yeah.
Signed up on both.
That's right. And you certainly could always donate to Magno as well. They need every dollar that they can get in order to fight the good fight. And let's amplify the effort in the run-up to the 25th. I know that Mardi Gras is right around the corner, and they're going to try and sneak it in.
The Super Bowl, too.
During the Super Bowl.
Bro.
That's what they're going to try and do, you know? And here's the thing. I'm telling you right now, and you should listen, heed what I'm saying right now. This ordinance is a bigger threat in more ways than the noise ordinance was.
Well, look, we're going to get into that next week. Tune in next week with Ethan Ellestad from Magno, who's going to be our guest on Tuesday of next week, and we're going to be posting that on Wednesday morning.
That's right.
We're going to talk way more about that sorry to cut you off, Jeff, but thinking about the way more, think about, you guys always talk about music incubators in this town. It threatens music incubators. This isn't just a Big Brother thing we're fighting against. It's just not how you feel about Big Brother government. There's language in this ordinance that shifts the power, right? Shifts the power in terms of the government being able to shut down bars and music venues.
Look, at the end of the day, I'll keep it short. At the end of the day, they want to basically eliminate due process for businesses to be able to defend themselves.
That's right.
Within the confines of City Hall. What's going to happen if this thing passes effectively is that it's going to rob you of your ability to go to permits, to go in front of the City Planning Commission, to go in front of the City Council, to go in front of the City Attorney. Four different avenues that you might have where you can say, hey, I want to defend myself. I don't think the city is right in their judgment of me. I don't think that this fine is right, et cetera, et cetera. It'll take all that off the table. It has lowered the range. It's expanded the range, of geographic territory around a business from 300 yards to half a mile.
Right.
And then lowered the number of complaints simultaneously from 10 to 5. So that means that any politician can get out of council chamber that doesn't like your business, go and call 5 people in a neighborhood group, or anybody who's antagonistic toward you. Contemporary Arts Center, you have somebody that complains about you all the time.
5 NIMBYs.
All they have to do is find somebody a half mile away, a half mile.
Right.
Go outside, crank up your car for 30 minutes at the loudest that it can, play your music as loud as you can, and then walk a half mile away and see if you can hear it. You can't, okay? You just can't do that. So this is an absurd, that one provision right there.
I don't know, Jeff, man. Sometimes people leave a bar and they walk a half a mile and they leave that empty beer bottle on that stoop.
Yeah, and they just go crazy in front of somebody's house.
They go, you know? They walk a half mile away to pee.
Yeah.
On somebody's yard.
Right, exactly. That's what exactly. They do. So you can see just in explaining that one provision that this is a crazy ordinance. Nobody understands it, and the last thing I'll say is that it's unprecedented in all major cities in the United States. No one has a program like this. The closest one that anybody has is Long Beach, California. That's it. No other city in the United States has this. It's crazy. It could only ever come from the mind of Stacey Head, and it just needs to be defeated because it's just nuts.
You know, people always talk about slippery slope issues. This isn't a slippery slope. This isn't like, oh, if you give them this much, if you give them the half mile, they're going to take 2 miles. No, this is like the dunk, you know, the baseball dunk booth. This isn't a slippery slope. This is you're wet, you're drowned. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, we're just
like at the carnival, the dunking booth.
Yeah, no, this is like I'm going to do one of those like alpine runs, you know, down an illegal ski range.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, that was a cliff.
The triple black diamond cliff.
Right, and you're just...
Triple black diamond cliff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's what that is. And you're just off the cliff.
Exactly.
Headed toward doom, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so there's no slope here.
No.
Right.
There's no snow. It's just a cliff.
It's a cliff.
There's no sliding. There's just a off.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just falling right now.
Yeah. You know those scenes in the movies where the car is dangling on the cliff?
There's not even that.
There's not a dangle.
There's not even a dangle.
Right. Yeah. You're just going
about
over.
Gravity.
Yeah.
It's just you're done. You're gone.
Exactly.
Dude, I got. Why are we transitioning to our guest? Can I switch up headsets? I got the bad headphone.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, man. Yeah. Here you go. You go right here. Yeah, just toss that on the table, Joel. You know, don't worry
about that. All right, thanks, guys. I guess we should get rid of the bad headphones. Because every week, somebody gets the bad headphones. But normally, I have more people.
So. I don't know. Yeah, I'll look into that.
All right. So, that's a good segue. Melissa Arujo. Is that right?
Arujo,
thank you. It's been like 10 minutes since I've heard it.
It's okay.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good.
Good. Tell us about your restaurant.
So Alma is focused on Honduran cuisine. Mm-hmm. We started as a small pop-up and we've been growing. Basically, we're right now in the stage of educating people what Honduran cuisine is. A lot of people has the same, let's say, version of food, the Hispanic food. It's all Mexican.
And
Mexico's all rice and beans, and Central America or South America is exactly the same. But it's actually not. It's the difference, you know. Honduras is basically a bridge in Central America with the way we were colonized. It was heavy Mayan, Native American, Mayan, Indian, and then a little tribes all around. And then the Spanish colonized the part where my family's from, La Ceiba, the Atlantic Ocean. Okay. And then the British colonized what Belize is and the upper part of it. And then the Spanish started bringing slowly slaves to work the fields. But that was only the part of the coast that they were. So you have a beautiful Creole cuisine that was infused with all these flavors that, you know, through the time is still a version of what the meaning of Creole is, because you can taste the African's influence, you can taste the Spanish influence, you can taste that British, and then the Native American, you know, Mayan, Indian, there. I myself, my family, my father's also mixed. Yeah. My grandmother is Mayan Hondurans, and my grandfather is Portuguese.
Yeah, yeah.
So my dad, it's Mutt. He looks more like my grandmother. And then my dad married my mother, which is Sicilian Italian. So I am mixed too.
Nice.
You know? It's so growing up in my house, both of my parents were very much adamant to learn our heritage, where we come from, you know? I like to say that I have, my backbone is very much my heritage. It guides me who I am and everything. But the way that I see my life and the way that I live my life is very American.
Yeah.
You know, I was born in La Ceiba, Honduras, and then okay. I was 2 months old when I was brought to the United States.
Okay. And where'd you guys land?
My family always had connections in New Orleans.
Okay.
So we landed, my uncle was already here. He went to the Vietnam War. My brother was also a Marine. So my parents, especially my mother's family, was in New York. And so they used to back and forth a lot. Yeah. And my dad's family too. So in the 80s, my dad decided it was time to, you know, immigrate to the United States. So here we are, you know.
Yeah.
We lived about 2 years in New Orleans, and then we moved to Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Because my dad was in the railroad business.
Yeah.
He was an engineer in there. So, you know, New Orleans was dying in that time, the railroad, and Providence was huge.
Yeah, yeah. How old were you when you moved up there?
I was about 2 years old, okay. 2, 3. And then I grew up there, and then my last year of high school, I came back to New Orleans.
Okay. And did you come back sort of on your own? Did your family make a move?
My dad decided it was time. It was too cold, so they decided to come back to New okay. Orleans.
So he retired or something at that point?
Yeah,
okay.
He retired at that point. And,
gotcha.
My other siblings were married and everything, so.
What was it like coming back for you? Was there a culture shock or just?
It was. Yeah. It was. I was very much a New England girl.
Okay.
And even that I came here in the summers to, I did Mardi Gras a couple of times and everything, my accent was very much New England accent. And
you're not a Patriots fan, are you?
I am not. I am a New Orleans Saints fan.
All right.
We can keep going.
But in my house, I have to say, my fiance, she is a Patriots fan.
Is that right?
Yes.
All right. You can have mixed household. That's fine. As long as there's some Saints in there. Right.
Exactly. I got into the restaurant business just for extra money, you know. Mm-hmm. I started working. I worked my way up from a dishwasher to a prep cook and everything. I was going to school to study, you know, for law. I was in my undergrad, and I decided that, you know what, I'm going to give this full time. So I moved back to New York to go to culinary school.
Okay.
I'm about to start culinary school, and I got an internship in Italy.
An internship in Italy?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was like,
did that have something to do with your heritage at all? Or?
My grandfather, he was in Sicily, and he made the, let's say that he worked, you know, through his friends and everything.
Sure, sure.
The way it works in here in New Orleans,
exactly.
You know, somebody opens the door and everything. Sure. So I got to go, and it was for 6 months.
Where were you?
In Milan.
In Milan, yeah.
Yeah. And after 6 months of working my ass off and everything, the executive chef offered me a job.
Yeah.
And he was like, do you want a degree, or do you want actually what makes a chef? I was this little punk with the eagle, you know, like every chef, that it was okay, fine, I'll take the job, you know, your name is very much, it's out there, and I'll work my ass off for you, and I'll become your executive chef someday. I give it out, 3 years later I was his executive chef.
Yeah, fucking
that's great. And I stayed there for 10 years, and then my mom got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I picked family over career. I came back to the United States. I came back to New Orleans. That year I came back, it was 2005 when Katrina happened. I came back in January. Katrina happened August 28th. My birthday's August 26th. Wow. So Katrina found me with a big hangover.
I bet.
Huge.
Good Lord.
Yes. And basically, you know, got rescued, sent to Houston, and had to start all over, you know, got offered a job in in Mexico. It was a contract of 4 years, and I was like, that's dollars or pesos? Because if that's peso, I'm not going.
Yeah, right.
So they were
right.
like, no, it's dollars. So it was a good experience. I was able to come home as often as I wanted to. The drive wasn't that bad either.
Okay.
So once that finished, I decided to come back home completely, and I started working for Susan Spicer, actually.
You did?
Yeah, okay. Mondo's.
Right, right. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, right. So you know Jennifer over there as well?
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
And I stayed there about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then Revolution came calling. I was one of the opening team in Revolution Restaurant.
Okay, right.
So I worked there about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And Doris Metropolitan came calling.
Okay.
So I was the executive sous chef at Doris Metropolitan. Stayed there for another year after basically 3 years of working in the French Quarter. I had enough.
You had enough?
Yes.
Of the French Quarter?
Of the French Quarter.
The French Quarter eats away at you.
Yes.
Over time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There's something about it, you know, that like, because early on, when I was in college, I partially paid for my way through college by I worked all the time, you know. So I was at UNO and I had a job, and I worked I'll put up your microphone I was a bellhop, and I remember that very vividly, that after a while I was just like, it wasn't even so much the work, it was just like something crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You have to deal with this craziness. And it's kind of insane, you know, like almost all the time. And just after a while, I was like, you know, I just don't want to be down here anymore.
Yeah, you know? And plus, the city knows that they have a parking problem, you know, in the French Quarter.
That's right.
And that's their goal mine.
Sure.
90% of the hospitality business industry workers work in the French Quarter.
That's right. Yeah.
It's insane how much parking tickets we have to pay.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Right.
They know that's the little gold mine. They won't change it. They actually went up in the prices of the meters.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's like, I was like, you know what?
Just overtaxing working class people.
Exactly. It's just ridiculous. So I decided that, you know what? I have a nice savings account, so I'm going to invest that money on me.
Good.
And that's how my first business was born in 2013, Savara Catering. And I built the business slowly for the last years, and now I'm paying all the bills.
So how many years have you had the catering company?
Since 2013, so that's 14, 15, 16, 17.
Going on 5 years.
Going on 5 years,
wow.
Yeah. And since the beginning, we were the first catering company in New Orleans to be completely farm to table.
Yeah.
We do business only with local farmers and our artisan vendors, and you know, I get calls from the large vendors. I'm like, sorry, dude, no.
Yeah.
It's all 100% locally sourced. So we do it through Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And sometimes when I have time to go to Tennessee, we go to get stuff from Tennessee.
One thing I want to switch gears here a little bit, that I have so many questions that I want to ask, because what you were talking about to me is there's so many deeply rooted New Orleans things going on here. And one of them that comes to mind is this, is that we know in New Orleans, like about certain immigrant groups that have come to New Orleans, Irish, Sicilian, African, not immigrants, but when we're speaking about that, but German. But I happen to know that New Orleans, even prior to Katrina, has a long, long standing population of Honduran Americans that live here in New Orleans. In fact, it's the largest Honduran American population of anywhere, you know. So also we know about Vietnamese population in New Orleans, but it doesn't get talked about as much. But I know, because I had a good friend in Mid-City, a lot of people living in Mid-City, as a matter of fact, and also in the West Bank as well. And so can you talk about that a little bit? Because you talked about you had family here.
Yes.
What's the connection there?
The connection is basically you're looking at the architecture of the French Quarter. Take the French Quarter and put it in Honduras. It's exactly the same. You know, we're so proud, as New Orleans say, New Orleans is French. New Orleans is not French.
Yeah.
New Orleans is Spanish.
Yeah.
It has a hint of French. You know, the original French Quarter burned down. The Spanish built the French Quarter the they know how to build.
You open the
front door, the huge front doors, the huge windows,
yes.
the patio in the middle, you
That's
know,
right.
the same thing in the back. That is for the hot summers. You open everything. Everything is like air conditioned. It moves through the houses.
Yeah,
right.
In the winter, you close everything down and everything stays warm. You know, the parks in the middle of the street, if you go to Esplanade or you go to Uptown, all those parks, all that, the culture itself is Spanish,
yes.
not
yes.
French.
Right.
You know, and the African influence goes very well with the Spanish.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what makes New Orleans so unique.
Yeah.
The people insist that we're French. No, we're not. you know, so the Honduras community comes in because we have the same culture, you know.
Right.
Because
right.
Spain dominated completely in Honduras. And it was, it's what? In plane, it's about 2 hours, two and a half hours plane ride. So it's easy.
But also going way back. There was this connection also because of the United Fruit Company,
yes,
right, and the bananas.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. So right. Honduras is the major import for the fruit company, which actually my grandfather built it.
Really?
Yes, huh. And then sold it to Honduras. Honduras government took it over in the 1980s.
Interesting.
And then sold it to Dole.
Right, to Dole.
Yes.
Okay, there you go.
So that's one of the biggest thing. And like everything, you know, that has been connected to history, United States had their doubles and Hondurans, their fingers, you know, in politics and everything.
That's
but
right.
But in itself, what brings the Honduras community here is the climate is exactly the same. You know, the food is close to it, and the politics is exactly the same. Don't get me started there.
So everything's familiar.
Exactly. Right. So that's
they got
one of
water,
the things.
Sewage and water board down there.
Yeah. So what's different is the Honduras community here hasn't been for, you know, many generations in the city has not made a presence into it and made more noise is because the Hondurans, even that immigrated here, the family had papers and the other ones that came didn't, already had jobs for their family under the table.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't start seeing people on the corner of the Lowe's or anything after Katrina.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot, it's also a lot of misunderstanding, thinking that all Hispanic people would look the same.
Mm.
We don't. Mm. Right. My little sister is blonde, blue eyes, and white.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, that's because of my mother. I look, I don't, you know, a lot of people is like, oh, you don't look Spanish. What the hell do I look like then? You know, it's like, oh, you look Indonesian. I was like, really? It's the eyes, you know, because of the Mayan in me. Mm. But it's basically a community has assimilated to the city and it has married into the city, and what you think is Hondurans is not anymore Hondurans through the generation.
It's That's
just
right. sure.
through the food and everything to keep the culture alive. Some of them has got into the American way that they have lost the Spanish.
And that brings me to my next question. So you passed through really an American upbringing. You came here very young, and then frankly you go to, you know, one of the most American places in a way, you know, in New England, right? You know,
yeah.
If I can say so, right? I lived in Connecticut, you know, I know what I'm talking about, right? And so anyway, not to say that there's huge immigrant groups in Connecticut and Rhode Island and communities in those areas, but how did you maintain your interest in authentic Honduran cuisine, having passed through that, when seemingly it's much easier to open a place that would be, you know, hypothetically more Americanized?
I have to give it to my parents. Both of them, you know,
I was hoping you would say that.
Both of them were like, in my house, my mom would speak Italian, my dad would speak Spanish, and then if you answer back in English, you would get slapped. You would have to pick one language to talk to each of my parents. So when my dad talked to me, you know, I talked to him in Spanish. And every summer, it was like half of the summers in Honduras. My grandmother was there. She was very adamant at teaching us our heritage. She had a huge property in the middle of the city, which is now downtown. In that time period, was 5 minutes away from downtown. Mm. You know, we're talking about, I think, at least 5 to 10 acres.
Mm-hmm.
It was mm-hmm. huge. And she had pigs, chicken, ducks, everything you can imagine.
Wow.
So as a kid, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and helping my grandmother at that time, I did not like it. I was like, okay, cool. You know, I have to do it because in my house, you had your chores and, you know, you had to do them. If you didn't do them, you would get slapped in the head again. You know, my parents didn't believe in counting 1, 2, 3. It was like, you do it, yeah,
right.
Because I say so, you know. And it was always, yes, ma'am, no, sir, you know,
right.
Very polite, which it was weird because it plays to the Southern politeness thing, you know.
Right, yeah.
To that. But even that I was in New England, I was always answering, yes, sir, no, ma'am. And it was just a sign of respect, you know. It was called more for the culture of Honduras and European too, just the respect to my elders and to my parents. And see, my dad would bitch at me, I wouldn't answer back, I would take it. So
okay.
My grandmother would basically teach me one part of it. I had, for example, I had this pig. Her name was Martha. Mm-hmm. I took care of this pig for freaking 5 years of my life. I love this pig because as an American, you can have a pig as a pet, you know, and the dogs are become part of your family. Well, not to my grandmother. The pig was for food. So one Christmas, my dad decides, let's go to Honduras for Christmas, you know. The pig literally was around 450 pounds. It was time to kill her. So I was playing in the street with my friends and I hear the gunshot. So I was like, oh, grandma killed another pig. Well, I took a nap, then I woke up around, I think, 10:30 at night, because Christmas in Honduras is the 24th, not the 25th. So you start cooking like a week, that week of Christmas, you start cooking everything, especially the tamales, everything in front, it takes a long time.
Yes.
So that time I woke up, they were doing the tamales, the first batch was already out. My mom was like, Melissa, do you want a tamale? I was like, yeah, sure, you know. And then my sister was next to me eating, and the other ones were doing more tamales. And my sister Mary turns around to me, and she's like, so how's that tamale? I was like, it's really good. It came out really good. Yeah? Yeah. That's Martha.
Oh.
You don't tell that to a 9-year-old. Oh. I started crying and
I'm sure you did.
You know, and then my grandmother took me apart and she was like, you know, this is the circle of life, blah, blah, blah. But trying to explain that to a 9-year-old, I was like,
that's not going to work.
That's not going to work. So that's one of the samples. And after that, she decided that I needed to know how to butcher from, you know, killing and everything. So every year I learned something new. And then when I went to Italy for my grandfather, it was another part of the family, you know.
Sure.
I learned. So that heritage was increased every year, you know. And without even me knowing, it was already putting the roots of what I was going to become as an adult. As a kid, in some part, I tried to, you know, rebellion about this. I am American. I'm not, mm-hmm. you know, but still me and the way I was educated and everything, it still came out. So and the time that now passing forward and I became a professional cook or chef, you know, when I created Silver Catering, I created it with the freedom to be able to create any menu that I wanted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started cooking for local French chefs here, my Honduran heritage. And one of my ex-girlfriends, she was like, you need to do this as a pop-up, but you need a restaurant. This is really good. And nothing, it's like right here in the market, you know. So screaming and kicking, I was like, let me see what happened. You know, I put it off, then I came back to it, and then I finally did the pop-up, and it just happened that Ian was doing an article on the first menu that I did it. It was...
Ian McNulty?
Yes. Yeah. It was on Algeria Point, actually, and the menu was, I think it was 2323. I think the menu's gone. It was a restaurant. They just was renting it for pop-ups or little events. Mm-hmm. So I did that one. That with those couple of lines that Ian gave me, Helen Hunt came to call me and it's like, I want to do an interview for you. I was like, all right. We became friends and she gave me a whole page in the Gambit.
Wow. Okay.
And then after that, it's just like every time I do a pop-up, something comes out, you know. Slowly for the past year and a half, we've been building our name as Alma. And the tickets, we sell it to the website and the whole thing. We're trying to pair with local breweries and distilleries to make them, you know, the focus of the alcohol, that the food can go with any of the alcohol and sure. everything, mm-hmm. so, you know. And finally comes to Rucaré. So Rucaré offered us to be in the launch pot. We had to do the application process. We went through it. They were very excited. So we were very excited. So now we're competing to have a spot there. You know, it's like an incubator for small businesses to grow and have eventually a brick and mortar.
At that spot,
yeah.
So how does that work when you say competing? Like,
so there is right now, Rucaré has five spots for new vendors. You know, right. They're turning over. So we're going to be featuring a steady menu for a week, basically. Yes, as much, they want to see how many people we can pull into the location.
I see.
And to have a proof of concept, basically.
Okay.
So we're going to be competing from February the 20th to March 4th. And okay. We're going to be right now also...
So 2 weeks.
Yeah. So we're going to be also participating in the Black Party, the Martin Luther King Black Party, for the New Orleans Centennial. We're going to be doing private catering. So basically, it's going to be like the launch of Alma. We want as many people to come out that week, you know, those days to taste the food, to say, hey, you know, give it a chance. You know, it's going to be completely different. The tamales are not corn tamales. They're masa tamales.
Okay.
You know, you have a little meal in itself. The rice and beans, how do I put it? You won't find rice and beans in my food. You will find rice, you will find beans, but different aspect into, you know, complementary into working into the food.
Yeah, yeah.
I cook traditionally, and I present it the way that I present my food, which is more upscale, you know.
Okay.
What you think is... you know, for example, the tres leches. Everybody loves tres leches. You know, it's a simple cake, but in my mind, I do the cake, I do the sauce a little bit, and then what I do meringue all over the cake, and just for fun, I torch the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
So you have a nice little dome that when you break into it, you feel the softness, the moist, and it's not all soggy. You have like layers. My food is about layers and the flavor that is in there. I named it Alma because in Spanish it means soul.
Oh, nice.
Mm. So it is my soul that you're getting into it, you know.
That's right. For me,
Alma is very personal. The way to the website is designed, to the way we present ourselves, to the way we sell everything about Alma. You are basically digging into my soul.
Yeah, yeah, that's killer. Yeah. So the Rucaré, they support the different folks who are coming in, like yourself, the different entrepreneurs or foodpreneurs, as they call them. They giving you guys kind of any guidance or support, or is it just the space, or how is that?
It's given classes to most of them are small business entrepreneurs, you know,
yeah.
That some of them are first time into the business. Other ones been working in the business, but now they're breaking out on themselves. So basically you're taking classes once a week.
Gotcha.
A group class, and then you have one-on-one. It was actually kind of cool. Is also my business partner for Alma, Pepper Bowen, is involved also in the project.
Okay.
Pepper is a food law attorney.
Okay.
So, yes. So she knows the ins and out of creating a business, you know, and everything. So, so she's involved in that in an advice sometimes, but you know, as all my other half, she's more the brainchild of the legal stuff, and I'm more the brainchild of
the soul,
of the soul, the concept, yeah. And everything. So it works good. And to the you know, to everyone involved in this project, it's basically pushing them out, giving them the platform and saying, hey, try this new, you know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not, it's nothing like the St. James St. Rock
market, right?
It's nothing like that. Those are small vendors too, but they have a big name after them, you know, and the whole yep. thing. This is more if you really want the local cuisine and everything, and you know, small, truly small businesses.
And it is, isn't it? Don't they focus at Rucaré on African, Caribbean, Latin cuisines?
Yes. I think in this particular one, I am representing the Latin. There is a Caribbean, and then three Creole.
Okay. Nice.
Yes.
Nice. And then
it's so funny because you could do all three.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And your goal is to have a brick and mortar. You said it wouldn't.
Yes. So depend if we get the spot, the slot for one of the pods there. We were planning to stay there 1 year, enough yeah. for us to prove the concept, prove that, you know, educate people and say, hey, you know, we're ready now to invest the amount of money that we need to have a brick and mortar.
Yeah, yeah.
New Orleans is a tough market to break into. You know, this city, a lot of people opens restaurants as like drinking a glass of water, and then 6 months later to a year later,
gone.
They're gone.
That's right.
And then to invest for a good restaurant, you know, it's $250,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Not even a good restaurant, Mama's and Papa's restaurant.
Yeah, all that money. Yeah,
exactly.
The soul out too.
And then, you know, you have, you're competing with big boys. I mean, you're competing with Bash, you're competing with Link,
that's
you're competing
right.
with Brennett's. So, you know, as a chef that I have worked in this business, in this city, I have learned, you know, that this city is about connections, about networking. And also, first of all, you have to have the audience to come in and yeah. buy your food. You can have 100 articles in the newspaper, but if people don't recommend you word of mouth, they won't come in.
That's right.
You know, so we're doing that legwork right now. We're educating, we're letting people taste the food, know what Alma is all about, and then mm-hmm. once we're ready, we're opening a brick and mortar.
Yeah, that's a cool neighborhood over there, right, where Rucaré is.
Yes, it's a working neighborhood. It's it's a transition neighborhood right now. It's getting gentrified very slowly. They're having a big push for the street itself, for Aretha Haley. It has changed a lot. You know, there's not too much walking traffic. That's what we need more. But in itself, the whole neighborhood is changing slowly.
Mm. And yeah, Joel, sorry, folks. Joel's having this reaction to some medicine that he's taking right now. I'm coughing a little bit as well. It's wintertime in New Orleans, you know, and it's hot outside. So, gosh, I had another question that I wanted to ask you, because we're getting on about 45 minutes here. But if you would, just what for the uninitiated, what's a good dish, that a great dish that no one really knows about? Coming from you.
Coming from myself, sopa de mariscos for Alma. Sopa de marisco basically is a seafood stock. I used to laugh a lot when I worked in Revolution, because the executive sous chef or the executive chef would say, hey, be careful with the lobsters, you know, they're expensive. And as a kid going in the summer in Honduras and it rains, you can literally in that time used to be able to just pick them out of the beach.
Put them in. Exactly.
So it wasn't, you know, like I grew up eating them. And Sopa de Mariscos, the seafood stock basically had its abundance of lobster, shrimp, fish, scallops, mussels, every seafood there was in the coast. And then you have a rich broth made out of coconut milk. You know, with a the broth of the coconut milk is mixed in with a vegetable stock. So, but the richness comes out of the coconut milk, you know, and then slowly you go and adding the seafood. So when you drink it, it's really good. You know, wonderful. When you're eating it. I think for Sever Catering, I think the most that we are known and we do a lot is shrimp and grits.
Shrimp and grits.
Yeah. Yes. When I moved back to New Orleans and I did grits for the first time for a restaurant, they told me to use water. I refused to use water in chicken stock for my grits.
What did you use, milk?
I use milk or half and half.
Yeah.
I do not put salt and pepper in my grits. No, sir. I will walk out of your kitchen before I do that.
Milk is the way to go with grits. Yeah.
My mother did my grits all the time with milk and a little bit of sugar, so they're a little sweet. So I refuse to cook them anywhere, anyhow. And, you know, I will not use water. I will not use chicken stock. The way that I cook them is heavy cream or milk, and then I put a little bit of sugar. And now for my shrimp and grits, what I do too is I infuse them with goat cheese, so they're actually more creamy.
Wow.
And then on top of once they're done, I do thyme, so you have that nice aroma. And then the shrimp, my barbecue sauce, is basically an old Creole recipe that I got from this beautiful, amazing lady that she lived in the bayou. And it's basically Worcestershire, Louisiana Tabasco sauce, a beer, rosemary.
What kind of beer? Just regular beer?
Any right? beer that any you beer? Want.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Whatever she had in her refrigerator. Yeah, right. You know, it's one pot thing. A lemon, you cut off the skin of the lemon and you throw, you know, the lemon in there. Garlic, rosemary, peppercorns.
Oh, yeah.
And that's it. You know, so you let it reduce about 75%, all of it completely to its nine thick. And then you throw in the butter.
Yes.
And then you have this amazing flavors, you know, with that butter and everything. It's just good. And then you saute the shrimp with salt and pepper. Again, a little bit of olive oil, garlic, and then you're whisking in slowly the sauce. So the nuttiness and the hot of the sauce with the sweetness of the shrimp and grits and the flavor of the goat cheese. It just comes all together.
Yes. Yes.
So it works very perfect. And I think that's one of the big sellers for Sever Catering.
Dude, you know, if they had food porn, you know how they have like the sex workers on the phone or whatever? You know, like, what do you call them?
Yeah, that would be it.
If they had that for food porn, you could make, if for some reason you couldn't cook, you could just talk about food.
Yeah, what was it, 976 numbers?
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
Dude, are you going to be serving that on Monday at the MLK?
Excuse me.
No, what we're going to be serving is going to be actually our pulled pork carnitas.
Okay.
So yeah, what we do, we take that pulled pork, the butts, we rub them in, we let it marinate with salt, pepper, and other ingredients for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Then we put them in a pan, then we get lard. So we get a bunch of lard, we melt the lard, and then we put in the pulled porks.
Yes.
You know, we put the pork's butts in there. And then we cook it slowly for about 12 hours.
So you're going to be slow cooking during the Saints game.
Yes. So basically what we're doing...
You'd be slow cooking lard in butts.
Yeah. Let me just so if you know about French cuisine, when you basically confit a duck.
Yes.
So very French.
Yes.
Take the duck out and put the pork in.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, the reason why I do that is because my grandmother used to dig a hole in the ground in the backyard, wrap it around with banana leaves, and then there, and leave it and let it cook there for about 12 hours. So it,
you put the coals in the ground.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Everything. So it basically is like a, you make like an oven with the earth and everything, you know, and all the ingredients.
Yes.
And so I needed to find something that would do the same process to breaking down the fat of the pork and everything.
Yeah.
What better way to just cook it with its own fat?
Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
It's so rich. When you take the, I don't even have to, I just have to put my two little fingers and pull off the bone, the pulled pork. And
it just comes right off.
It comes out white completely. It's like, wow. So we are going to be serving that with homemade tortillas. And then on top of it, we do a chimol, which is exactly like a pico de gallo. The only difference is that it's done with apple cider vinegar.
Ah.
And a little bit of a lime juice.
Okay, okay.
So, and no jalapenos.
Mm-hmm. No jalapenos.
So, yes. So, I twist it a little bit. And what I do, I use cane vinaigrette.
Yes.
So, I use Louisiana local smitty cane vinaigrette.
Yes.
So, it takes, it has the vinegar, but it also has the sweetness of it. So, I do that. And then I just mix it in and let it marinate, and that comes out. So it gives it a sweet, when you're eating the pork, you have a sweetness in your back of your palate, and then the nuttiness of the fat of the pork, it just works really good. And so we're doing that.
Yes.
And then we're doing a tres leches.
Yes.
So we're going to do those two items, and we're going to be selling them.
1977 Almanola.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
It's just $35 a minute.
You know what I just thought of is that our buddy Griper is like a huge fan of Latin American cuisine, for lack of a better way of describing it. He's going to kill us.
That he
wasn't here. Yeah,
exactly.
Right, exactly. Like,
he is.
Yeah, because Griper's thing was like, hey, Jeff, taco party at the house tonight, man?
Yeah.
I'll make some tacos. You know, and he would come over here and he'd make, anyway, Griper's going to be mad at us.
He's going to be super mad. But we'll take him, if not on Monday, we'll take February 20th to March 4th. It's 2000 Aretha Castle at Haley Boulevard, right?
Yes, correct.
That's where Rucaré is?
Yes, we will be opening from 11 o'clock to 4 o'clock on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays. Fridays and Saturdays, we will be opening from 11 to 8, and Sunday from 11 to 4.
And so you guys getting the year-long pot over there is dependent upon people coming over there and ordering food?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, and how do
everybody get over there and
people
order?
People want to find you online.
You can find us on Instagram, Almanola, and you can find us also on Facebook, Almanola. And our website is very easy, www.almanola.com.
Yeah, it's a great-looking website. And and then this Monday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which New Orleans celebrates MLK Day.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And we celebrate it. I'm off work. The building where I work is closed. Offices are closed to the public. And it's a day that we take seriously, or that we celebrate.
Yeah, it's a national holiday.
Well, for good reason.
Yeah, exactly. And it should be revered as such.
So I'm definitely going to be nursing my Saints victory hangover by going over to
let's
the
not
MLK.
Jinx it. Let's
I know, sorry.
Yeah.
I've already been talking black and gold Super Bowl. I'm beyond jinxing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be jinxing it if I didn't talk shit, because I've already talked so much shit. But Monday, noon to 4, it's the block party right there at 2000 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. Right at Rue Carré. Is there going to be music and stuff like that? Do you know?
I think so, yeah. I think the whole block is just going to be a whole big party.
Festivities, I'm sure. Family friendly. Come on down and remember MLK. And I mean, now more than ever, I mean, it feels like we're saying that all the time with what's happening nationally, what's happening in Washington, D.C. Civil rights is important. Never stop being important, but boy, does it feel like alarmingly important now.
Absolutely, Absolutely.
My father was huge also in history. He taught us we need to learn our mistakes from the past to not make them the same in the future and move forward. Yeah. I think a lot of people, what they need to do if they have doubts is educate yourself. Yeah. Everything about our current president and his business is public record.
Yeah.
Just Google it, you know. Yeah. Yeah. All his fails business, it's public record, you know.
Yeah.
All the stuff, you just need to Google and educate yourself. And out of there, you need to make the right decisions.
Unfortunately, there's a group of people in this country that think that being educated means you're an elitist. I mean, that's what he ran on, you know, is that us educated folks who know how to Google stuff.
I think he ran more into fear.
That's right. Yeah.
There's always a perspective in the United States that we're the best in the world. We're the badass. You know, we're the best country in the world. And that's false.
Yep.
The rest of the world doesn't like us at all. Right. They like our money. They like our army. But that's they don't right. like us because we are arrogant, you know. Right. We show this big-ass pride about our country, which is amazing, good, you know, but we need to learn to be humble.
Yeah.
And we need to learn to listen, especially inside our own country.
That's right.
We are a melting pot, you know.
Yeah.
We, and right. the problem is that, you know, as a minority, a lot of people, when they see me, they don't see an American citizen. They see my race.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know anything about me. They just assume because of my race that I'm uneducated, that I wash dishes,
right?
You know, and that I'm not legal.
Right.
It's a lie.
Yeah, of course.
I'm an American citizen. I do have an education.
Yeah.
I am a small business owner, and actually, I have experience in firsthand races in my age. Not only because of my race, also because of my sexuality.
Right.
You know, and for me personally, what we have right now in the White House is a slap in the face because two generations of my family have served.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, my uncle served in Vietnam. My brother served in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was ROTC all through high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
And, you know, so I will not bow my head down to something that I will not believe.
Of course.
And as a business owner, especially in a Republican state, I am very happy that New Orleans is blue. But I have lost business.
Yeah.
Because I am very much, I say what is in my mind, and I will not be quiet.
Good.
And I think that people need to learn to listen to each other and learn to do the research and not be so much afraid of the other person and not the past. Because if you're making your decisions or the mistakes we made in the past, we'll never will move on. Because we also need to teach our history correctly. We don't do that. You know, one of the things that Germany is very successful is they don't hide their mistakes in their history.
That's right.
They teach it.
That's right.
We do. We hide it.
We sure do.
And we don't teach it.
Yeah.
And there is so much resentment built in this country because of it.
Yeah.
You know, I lost friends that have eaten at my table and they were like, you don't know what you're talking about. I was like, I do because I leave it every day. There's one time that I was driving to Kenner. The police officer stopped me. I drive a Grand Cherokee.
Yep.
Brand new. You know, they stopped me. And the first thing that he asked me is, ma'am, is this your car? I was like, I'm sorry, but are you profiling me?
Yeah, good.
And he just went down like, it's like, he walked around the car and everything. He's like, license and registration. I pulled it out. I pulled my phone, gave him my insurance. He wouldn't take the app. He wouldn't take the recitation.
It's required.
Yeah.
It's required in the state of Louisiana.
So you know what I did? I hit a button in my car. I called my brother, who's a lawyer. My brother
good
got there. And you
good
know, he wanted to take the car away
because
he didn't believe that it was my car because of my race.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, screw you. God, you're not taking my car away.
Right.
You know? And he's like, well, you can't talk to me like that. I know my law.
Right.
I can't be disrespectful to the law. But to the person, to you, I can do it.
That's right.
And you can't take my car without any, you know, not because of suspicion or anything. You opening yourself in the ground of profiling me to a lawsuit to you and to the police station.
That's right.
So as soon as my brother got there, you know, we resolved it. He didn't take my car. I got written up a ticket of $700.
What?
Which I had to pay.
For what?
For what? Something like being...
He took my license plate because he wouldn't take the insurance.
Offending the fragility of the officer?
Yeah, because of his damn eagles. So he took my license plate. So
good
it's,
God.
You know, it's educating people and learning from the mistakes.
Sure.
And unfortunately, that's a common story that you hear all the time. We hear it here on the podcast when we have people that we interview. And we, you know, that's I think, one of the reasons for our podcast is to try and get that word out there and to reach out to people and have those stories told. And so that a greater number of people in this country, you're never going to be able to win everybody over because there's always going to be a intransigent population of people who are like diehard racists and you know, xenophobes, but at least maybe there's some people that you can convince and we can get this country going back on the right track at some point. And to close, I just wanted to say that we share something in common because I'm from Sicilian heritage. You're from Sicilian heritage.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask something because in my family, there's a there are recipes from that side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
That's the side of my family that I know the best, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not no surprise there, right? You know? And but but like we have a dish called pasta cacciata that we make. It's like a casserole,
mm-hmm.
you know. And is there something like that that your mother made, you know, from the Italian side that was
yes.
something special?
Actually, for me, but when I'm sick, I want bolognese.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A lot of people have a different American, Italian American is totally different than authentic Italian, you know?
Yes.
We, that's right. We crunch our pasta in sauce. We want a lot of sauce. And the way my mom did her bolognese was very simple. I'm not going to talk about it because, you know, I don't want any
don't
more food porn in here. But
go ahead.
So she started with a pot, a little bit of olive oil, garlic, shallots, you know,
yeah.
A little bit of thyme into it. Then the meat, it was 100% beef or 100% pork, depending what she was in the mood for, you know. Or sometimes we had lamb, too. Ground lamb, and once the meat went in there, a nice bottle of wine went in it too.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
You know, and caramelized red onions because a lot of people use sugar actually to make it a little bit sweet. You don't we use sugar, but I learned from my family not to use sugar. Use a nice bottle of red wine, and that the sweetness comes out of the red wine and the caramelized onions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you cook that down, then you throw in the red sauce, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make it from scratch to your house. My mom used to do that, and once that is done nice, she made the pasta from scratch. The way we boil pasta is you get a big pasta bowl of water, you put a lot of salt,
right? Right.
Not one to 2 or 3 tablespoons. You get your whole hand, you put your fist, you get the whole fist of salt, you throw it in the water.
Right.
Once that is boiling, you you throw in the pasta, then you take it out, you know, you put it on the cold water, so you stop the cooking process. Then you get the olive oil and put it in the pasta and move it around, you know.
That's right.
That's
how you do it, folks.
Exactly.
That's how you cook. And al dente, right?
Yes, al dente.
Right.
And then you get the pasta, you put it in a little bowl, and then you put a little bit of the sauce with the meat, and you move it around. You want to coat the pasta. You don't want to drown it.
That's
because
right.
you actually want to taste the pasta. That's the main dish.
Right.
So when I was a kid and I was sick or anything, my mom used to cook that for me, and that's my comfort food.
Yes. Yes. Okay, mm-hmm. great. And then you get the good grana, maybe, you know, yeah. Put it on top, right?
Yeah.
Not too much.
Though. Not too much. Right. That's a little bit. You know, I am not a wine drinker because I guess since a kid I've been drinking it. The Italian culture starts giving the kids berry H when they're babies.
Sure.
And the Coke and wine in the bottle.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
To start training us, I don't like specifically wine. I am more an alcohol, like a hard liquor drinker.
Mm-hmm.
So I love my ports. That's my dad's side.
Oh, port. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's your father's side.
That's my father's side. I like the sweet wines and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
I'm more like the rum too. It's in my blood.
Rum is in your blood. Yeah.
Yes.
Which one?
I like the Cuban.
The Cuban.
Oh yeah. My God! When I go to Mexico and I'm driving, let's say that some bottles of Cuban rum.
Methusalem, maybe. That's one. I think it's from.
I think this one. I don't remember the one. I buy basically cheap Mexican rum and throw the liquid out, and then put the good one in the bottle. Pass it over. Sorry. Yeah.
So, like you do.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So when I go through immigration, they say, oh, yeah, it's Mexican. Yeah. But I haven't done that in a long time, people. Don't worry. So I love that, you know. So, yeah, as a good chef, I eat, I drink, and live life.
Like you should.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's a good life.
It's a good life.
That's right. Exactly. That's right. So Melissa, we're gonna see you this Monday at the block party, MLK block party.
Yep.
And then February 20th through March 4th, we're gonna see you again. I'm definitely gonna come by and eat your food, and I hope everyone out there listening comes by as well. And I hope you guys are very successful. And best of luck to you. And thank you for coming on.
I don't see how you could not. After those descriptions.
No, exactly. Well, and clearly people are responding to your food because I saw some of those write-ups that you were referring to. Clearly people dig your food. So that soul is shining through.
I am very humble every time that somebody loves my food and comes to eat my food, you know. As a chef, I still get nervous every time somebody orders it. If I don't eat it, I don't serve it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I am committed.
That's a good rule.
I'm committed to have the best quality products there and eat, you know, serve something that I have so much pride in and also that I would eat.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to having some for sure.
Boy, same here. I tell you what, yeah. I'm hungry.
Me too.
That's all I can say, me right? Too.
But thank you again so much for coming on, and we'll put all those plugs on the post as well, your website and everything, and and yeah, best of luck to you, and enjoy your carnival time. I'm sure you're gonna be gearing up for that March 20th date through carnival. But I hope you get to enjoy it, and then best of luck, and maybe we'll check back in with you when you get closer to that brick and mortar, you know. And again, thank you so much for coming on, Melissa.
All right, thank you guys.
Appreciate it.
It's a good life, babe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans, folks. We're gonna have a part two where we talk about the Saints.
Yeah,
you can't get out of here without talking about playoffs and the Saints.
That's right, baby.
And we'll be back. Click on part two, and we'll see you then, folks.
Yeah, you're right.